Okay, hi everybody. And now we're in a position to continue a little bit anyway. We're on program number 63. And this, I'm trying to get everything adjusted here. Just excuse me. Golden Gate Bridge behind us. And that, of course, is a symbol of the bridging work that has to be done as we attempt to move from the last throes of the old age into a very solid Aquarian civilization, entered, of course, in the right way. So we had finish this little point again. He gives us some very interesting items of information, but basically they're more to stimulate the conception of the planetary logoic pattern. That's their value, I think. The masters themselves are only learning the will of the planetary logos. Maybe they have something of the first syllable of his name, maybe not even the entire first syllable. The objective of effort in Shambhala is, however, the apprehension of solar purpose, the plan of which is working out in the highest levels of our planetary system. Let's just kind of make that, you know, a little brighter, a little more outstanding. Just as the will, purpose, and plan, I guess in that order, of Shambhala work out on the three lowest levels of our planetary system. At least they are certainly meant to change everything in the manifestation of the plan. Again, this item of information serves only to indicate hierarchical objectives, and those objectives extend away from time and space into the mind of God himself. So we are to assume that within the mind of God, the manner in which we recognize or apprehend time and space is far transcended. I mean, if a human being can understand the illusory nature of time as usually conceived, then certainly within the consciousness of the planetary logos, it is far transcended, and our notion of space is as well transcended. They are ultimately unrealities. And one of the first steps towards overcoming illusion is to overcome the apprehension of time and space as usually conceived. So here we are then on page 534, it looks like. And our date is June the 1st. And let's just see a little bit here. Yeah, 534 is correct. So there are certain synonyms which may serve to develop your synthetic thinking, and so bring in a definite measure of enlightenment. So it's not for nothing that this kind of tabulation is mentioned, and then, of course, it has to become meaningful to us. The three divisions are the three major centers within our planetary scheme: Shambhala, hierarchy, and humanity. And this is important. I can see that Shambhala is the home of synthesis, in which there is a oneness of all perceptions. And hierarchy is the home of unity, in which the perceptions remain distinct, but somehow all a part of each other, and humanity subject to the lower mind, particularly, maybe with its fifth ray personality at the moment, is given to the apprehension of separation. Now, there have been a lot of discussions that I've had with well-read students about will and purpose. Now, here we seem to have it, that will is a driving force, an energy that is native to Shambhala. Purpose, it's sort of the, you know, will is sort of the first ray of the first ray, if we look at sub-rays. And when it comes to purpose, it carries a kind of second ray quality in relation to the major first ray, because the second ray is the ray of the divine pattern. And it seems, as purpose is usually applied, there must be a pattern worked out in the lower worlds. And plan has a lot to do with sequential execution of various steps, which bring the purpose about, all driven by the will. I find this to be, I don't know, somehow an important statement. It is what I have promoted, but the arguments in the other direction have been good and understandable. When it comes to Shambhala, we have the life aspect. We're familiar with that. Life is the all animating something, which continues to keep, what can I call it, the various aspects of creation in manifestation. If life as we're here considering it were to disappear, then also the different emanations and extensions and divisions of the one great planetary being, or even of the one great universal being, would disappear. Soul is another name for consciousness, and there is a soul of the universe as well as a soul of something much smaller, namely our planetary system. And when it comes to appearance, well, in a way, you know, the appearance is found within the dense physical body of the planetary logos, but from another perspective, there are different and greater logoi, and the appearances encompass much more than simply that which is found upon the cosmic physical plane. But definitely the cosmic physical plane is a plane of appearance, but there are beings for whom the seven cosmic planes are really a kind of etheric physical plane, with the cosmic logoic, cosmic monadic, cosmic atmic, and cosmic buddhic being ethers, and all other planes subsidiary to that, the cosmic mental, cosmic astral, cosmic physical, are considered to be the dense physical body of some super cosmic logos. I can't be specific about what we could call it. You know, when it comes to life and spirit, sometimes we have to divorce these two from any connection with a quality, like such as a first ray quality. It's something fundamental to rays 1, 2, and 3 into the first three aspects. So we have to be watchful. Sometimes life and spirit are connected with the first aspect of divinity, but maybe more authentically, they should be connected with something that sustains the will, sustains the purpose, sustains the plan, all three. So the idea is not to confuse the first aspect of divinity, which is will, with life itself at the core of will, wisdom, activity, will, purpose, plan. Purpose, of course, goes with wisdom, and plan goes with activity. But it's easy, when looking at the word will, to think of it as the very center of life for all three aspects of divinity. On the other hand, the conventional way of looking at it is as associated with the first aspect. I hope I'm making myself clear. There's a little kind of potential confusion there between the first aspect and the absolute life at the core of the first, second, and third aspects. So again, with spirit, it's the same. It's not that spirit is the first aspect of divinity. For practical purposes, it may, with the monad in a way, reside in Shambhala. But there is Shambhalic awareness and consciousness too, you see. And consciousness is generally associated with the sensitivity of the second aspect, the ability to touch and respond, touch in even some subtle way. And substance may be considered material, but another way of looking at substance is a particular sustaining energy which substands a cruder, more material energy. As I've said before, the etheric nature is substantial to the dense physical, the astral is substantial to the etheric physical, and the mental is substantial to the astral, etheric, physical, and so it goes. Substantiality is that which lies beneath and within, and in a way, substance, finally, is life itself. I think we have to avoid thinking of life as associated only with the first aspect of divinity. It is something far more inherent. The same with livingness. It's life sustaining. And it sustains the will as well as the consciousness, as well as the activity or the plan. So, but in this case, livingness, the power of Shambhala in relation to our earth, can be said to hold the various aspects of manifestation in a state of presence or to make them disappear through non-livingness. Organism can only be accomplished in a unity, and unity is derived from the right relations ruled by the second ray. Organization is much more separative and has to do with interfunctioning divisions, but not yet quite with the unity. And that's why DK is constantly emphasizing the organism of the second aspect and not the organization of the third aspect, and especially of the subsidiary seventh to the third. This one's a little harder maybe to grasp. It seems more to do with consciousness, you know, so it seems that apprehension involves simply registration of some kind, the raw fact of registration. Polarization is always dividing into two, and whatever is apprehended, that is perceived, usually, unless identification has taken over, has two opposing poles with some kind of neutral state in the center. As far as the focus of activity goes, it's based on separation. And the raw fact of apprehension exists, and then we focus on a certain segment, apparently a divided, separate segment within the field of perception, and within that segment we find polarization. So, you know, this is a little, I find it a little more difficult to understand and also to explain. But at least apprehension takes us into registration, the raw fact of registration. And the focus of activity will tell us what we register, what we're registering, and may promote activity in that which is registered, but definitely polarization will appear in our dualistic universe, and you cannot have emanation without dualism, because the mere fact of going forth from the whole produces a polarization. Now here, this is interesting. The power is associated with this driving force of Shambhala. You see, we can extend these ideas about Shambhala all the way up to other types of beings. There's always a 1, 2, 3 of it. And power is what keeps the whole thing progressing, not only sustained, but interacting. And momentum is the tendency to keep going. Now we're told that the second ray approach is rather different from the crashing through of the power aspect. I think in the Taurus chapter in esoteric astrology, we can find that. Momentum is the tendency to drive forward without let up and without leeway, and to continue forward. It has a, you know, definite definition in physics and so forth, but the idea is that resistance does not stop it, and it continues. Actions are specific within the apparently divided field, empowered by the driving will, and carrying forward with its own momentum. So actions have to do with specific types of work within the field being considered, and usually involve the idea of the separation of the different parts and how they act upon each other. When it comes to, these are very different kind of triplicities. And if we study them and ponder them, I think it will lead to a more synthetic grasp of reality, as DK seems to tell us. I'm kind of improvising on what strikes me here, but it will develop synthetic thinking and a measure of enlightenment. Certainly, even the Buddha does not have complete enlightenment. He does with respect to the cosmic mental plane, as it can be applied to the cosmic physical plane. He has enlightenment in that respect. But those words are so far beyond anything we can truly apprehend that they're just, you know, suggestions. The Shambhala provides the ongoing energy, again, which sustains. It's a lot like livingness. And the wide sharing, you know, it's a secondary word, is signaled by distribution. It's also an Aquarian modality to distribute throughout a whole. And there are specific applications to different parts of that articulated wholeness, and to some it looks like a separated field. Specific application of forces, which let's call it directed energy. So the energy is distributed over the whole, but forces direct it in specific ways. Now, with regard to Shambhala, certainly this monadic, what do we call it, destiny, involves the idea of direction and the straight line and progress onward and forward movement and all that, not spiral cyclic and not cyclic alone. And then as one follows the direction, there is a transmission of the energies which are being directed, and certain receivers in the field, which are more distinct, and that covers the third ray of reception. Well, you know, hierarchy is a transmitting body, receiving from Shambhala and giving. Now, in a way, every center of energy both receives, but both gives and receives. Maybe there's some kind of inert energies at the bottom of the creative hierarchies that is only a receiver. And sometimes we hear that the moon is a dead planet and that it does not radiate anything. It simply receives. I mean, it does have an effect because there's the effect of the decaying structure, which is unhealthy and which we not so much receive but are afflicted by. Humanity and our entire planet are afflicted by these products of disintegration. But in general, if we become a member of the hierarchy, we will be very Janus, the two-headed god, in our approach. We will look toward Shambhala and receive, and then we will send it towards humanity, which will be, in this triplicity, the true receptor. And then, you know, sort of summing it up anatomically, Shambhala is the head and hierarchy is the pumping heart, if I may say so. And humanity are articulating creation through the throat. This is not an easy tabulation, I think you will see. I don't find it easy, but I look for places where confusion is liable to arise simply because of the use of English words. And that one place where I find it most probable is the confusion between the true life essence and the first or will aspect. I always somehow differentiate those, even though they are often lumped together. Well, DK sums it up for us. I mean, I could kind of go on here, but I don't want to be tedious as I try to work out the meaning. But if you read them vertically, you know, another point of view might appear rather than horizontally. Synthesis, will, life, spirit, livingness, apprehension, which really means grasping somehow, power, energy, direction, head. And if we read the words associated with hierarchy, we have unity, purpose, soul, consciousness, organism, polarization, momentum, distribution, transmission, and heart. I don't know, maybe I think that one's easier to understand than the first. And then with regard to humanity, with its still separative consciousness, we have separation, plan in time and space, appearance, substance, organization, focus of activity, action, forces, reception, throat. So I would suggest, you know, that if you want to go deeper with it, set up some horizontal considerations, ponder for a little while, then the next horizontal relationship, ponder for a little while, so forth, and then set up the vertical relationships and maybe ponder longer. But somehow steeping yourselves in these triplicities will, as DK is suggesting, develop synthetic thinking, which is the kind of thinking characteristic of the abstract mind and not so much of the bewildering concrete mind. And the enlightenment will come from the spiritual triad. And that's quite a high step above our normal concrete-minded considerations. I wonder if we realize how concrete-minded most of humanity seems to be, and also disciples who tend to make concretions out of what is meant to be apprehended abstractly. So it becomes an abstraction, becomes a concretion, and loses thereby its extended applicability. DK tells us it will be apparent to you how little you can understand of the Shambhala intention when you realize that it is not easy for you to see any true distinction between unity and synthesis, and at the same time, how impossible it is for me to make the distinction clear. Well, we have taken that up just a little bit, because, you know, in the imprecise use of language, there is a real problem. And even the Tibetan with Alice Bailey uses certain language with various degrees of precision. Unity does not convert all perceptions to oneness, to the same substance, but it does create a kind of harmony and right or ideal interactivity between the elements perceived, the factors perceived. When it comes to synthesis, especially even an articulated synthesis, the one substance of all the different perceptions is registered until it doesn't make any difference what kind of variety you see. It all appears essentially as, let me call it, co-substantial. Co-substantial. And then here comes this famous statement, which is used by all of us, often without much meaning, but frequently anyway. All I can say is that synthesis is, whilst unity is achieved, and is the reward of action and effort. Well, does that mean anything to us? See, oneness is, but the various factors which exist in the interactivity of apparently separated units have to be brought into an ideal relationship which pure reason reveals. So unity has to be, in a way, created. And, you know, let me help this stand out. All I can say is that synthesis is, whilst unity is achieved and is the reward of that third aspect that we call action and effort. So, you know, ponder on this. We cannot prevent the underlying unity, the underlying synthesis in any respect. It simply is a fact. You know, one asserts the fact of the oneness and the ultimate synthesis of all apparent differences. But even though they are all these differentiated perceptions are co-substantial in oneness, doesn't mean they're going to be in an ideal relationship. So let's just say unity, can I do this? Unity involves relationship, and synthesis is in its highest aspect beyond relationship. I wonder if that can mean something to us. You know, obviously I struggle, just like anyone would struggle, to somehow come to a deep understanding of these matters. And after all, we're dealing just with words. And the word is simply the outer expression, or maybe the indicator of a state of perception or infusception, which must be registered. So, you know, the thing is, meditate upon these things, enter a state of contemplation as possible, as may be possible, and see what is the nature of your apprehension at that point, the nature of your consciousness, and how is it in a way qualitatively different? How is the consciousness or awareness of synthesis qualitatively different from the consciousness or awareness of unity? And certainly maybe it's easier to note the difference between unity and simply, is it action? No. It's not action, it's separation. So we human beings, we're still confined to the realm of separative apprehension, if I can call it that, separative consciousness. And we have to find the way to make the bridge into a kind of articulated state of right relationship, which tolerates no separation between the factors that are perceived as related. As you progress upon the path of initiation, the meaning of unity clarifies. As you direct yourself towards the way of the higher evolution, synthesis emerges. More than that, it would be useless for me to say. And you know, the Tibetan who is in those higher states of registration knows whereof he speaks. And we who are still, you know, just dealing with concepts, we say, why not? Just tell us. But of course, he knows the confusion that would result. This problem of the apparently impenetrable darkness of intention, as grasped by Shambhala, of meaning, of inscrutability, of a spiritual imperviousness which holds, in spite of all fluctuations in the three worlds of human evolution and the remaining two of superhuman unfoldment, provides a situation to which the hierarchy has to make adjustment through alignment. Now, what a sentence. What a sentence that one is. So wouldn't you agree? Maybe worth repeating? The problem of the light that's so intense that it's dark. This problem of apparently impenetrable darkness, it's not necessarily impenetrable, it's only apparently so from where we stand. This problem of the apparently impenetrable darkness of intention, as grasped by Shambhala, and whose intention is it anyway, you know, that of the Soul of Logos, who probably has its own problems grasping intention of a cosmic logos or a supercosmic logos and on, as grasped by Shambhala, this problem of meaning, of inscrutability, it cannot be easily explained and is always mysterious, of a spiritual imperviousness. It cannot be penetrated. Like when something is impervious to water, it's not only water resistant, it's waterproof. So the way we usually would approach can't get through. Of a spiritual imperviousness which holds, in spite of all fluctuations in the three worlds of human evolution, and the remaining two of superhuman unfoldment, namely the Buddhic and Atmic plane, it holds, it abides, you know. And let us use that word. It abides. In spite of the fluctuations in the three worlds of human evolution and the remaining two of superhuman unfoldment, Buddhic and Atmic, provides a situation to which the hierarchy must make adjustment through alignment. And we've seen already in our maps that hierarchy is not fully aligned with Shambhala. Not yet, not now. In the future, yes. But remember this idea of adjustment through alignment, when we can really align, we human beings can align with hierarchy, then the adjustments needed to work cooperatively with hierarchy will exist. And the same is true for hierarchy in relation to Shambhala. I think sometimes Shambhala is just a word and we think of it in a way as too close to hierarchy. But just think, in Shambhala there are three Buddhas of activity, and maybe the esoteric Buddhas too, or the esoteric Kumaras, who were planetary logoi in the previous solar system. Now that's way beyond what the Christ or a master has achieved. You know, we're talking about the planetary logos having stood at the stage of mastership of the fifth initiation, and it's many cycles ago, and the cycles are big ones. And I suppose we're talking about Mahakalpas. We're talking about great ages. So if we want to see what is the real proximity of Shambhala to hierarchy, we should not underestimate the distance. It's quite a distance. And simply to enter Shambhala as a Chohan is the ground floor, and nothing like the kinds of power and consciousness and state that exists for those beings who were even planetary logoi in previous solar systems. So a sense of proportion as to developmental distance is really, really important. And it isn't going to be given to us unless we really ponder about it. Okay, so it goes on and says, you are in your small way. Ah, I guess it says what I said, only, of course, better. You are in your small way, making your adjustment to the hierarchy through a steady construction of the Antikarana. And in so doing, are aiding the construction of the Antikarana, which unites humanity in the hierarchy, the first few strands of which were established through the sacrifices of certain of the sons of God when the hierarchy was founded on earth. So we cannot expect that the connection with hierarchy as it is now exists at the same state of primitivity as it did when hierarchy first established itself on earth. But I guess the idea is here that the Antikorana helps with adjustment to the next higher center. And well, there's an Antikorana separating Earth from Venus, and we know that the Earth Logos is attempting to approximate the attainment of the Venusian Logos. I hope I'm not lurching too much here. I think I'm doing a little bit of lurching, you know? And I don't want to lurch excessively. Okay. So, you know, getting rid of some things here. I always carry too much on my computer. It's a bad habit, you know. And hopefully I can one day stop it. Okay, today the hierarchy, let's see where we are here. Yeah. Today the hierarchy is working at the establishing of the linking strands between itself and Shambhala. And good progress has already been made. It might be said here that for the past 700 years, well, what would that take us to, about 1,246, roughly, 1,245, since this was written in 45-46, it might be said here that for the past 700 years, the chain of hierarchy has been complete. And by this, I mean that the planetary rainbow bridge uniting the three centers has existed, but I think, you know, not in the fullest development. The bridge exists, but here we are with this Golden Gate Bridge in back of the picture, you know. The bridge exists, but it is not maybe fully developed, or maybe DK will contradict what I just said. Let's see. Today, the hierarchy is working at the establishing of the linking strands, well, still today, between itself and Shambhala, and good progress, not complete progress, but good progress has already been made. It might be said here that for the past 700 years, the chain of hierarchy has been complete. By this, I mean that the planetary rainbow bridge uniting the three major centers at least has existed, you know. Completed does not mean fulfilled, I guess. The task ahead of these three major centers, working in alignment through adjustment, because of the alignment, being able to adjust, is to strengthen and beautify, if I may so express it, to electrify this bridge, thus producing full planetary intercommunication, full, right, between the three centers and the four minor centers, so that the weight of the will of God, the momentum, there's our words, of the purpose of Sanatkumara and the plan of his representatives may progress unimpeded from point to point, from sphere to sphere, from glory to glory. This is one of those wonderfully explanatory sentences. So let's just kind of make this outstanding. Yes, the task ahead of all these three major centers working in alignment, having achieved that alignment through adjustment, I imagine constantly adjusting the alignment as well, is to strengthen and beautify, if I may so express it, to electrify this bridge, thus producing full planetary intercommunication, or yes, planetary intercommunication. It's not full yet. Between the three centers and the four minor centers. And by the four minor centers, I suppose we're going to mean the inclusion of the Ajna, solar plexus, sacral, and base of the spine. So that the weight of the will, now this is not, this is all about gravity and impression from above and the coming together of different units within the whole according to the dynamic of gravitation. So that the weight of the will of God, the momentum of the purpose of Sanat Kumara just keeps on going under the pressure of the weight, and the plan, working out the specifics, of his representatives may progress unimpeded from point to point, from sphere to sphere, from glory to glory. This is a magnificent sentence. And if we go back a little bit, we'll recognize that DK did use the words will, momentum, and plan, or will, purpose, and plan. So all is in progress, all is in good hands, all is irresistibly moving forward, though delays may exist. And of course, with delay would come friction and suffering. And if humanity could but understand the method, all of these results of obstruction that it presents would be greatly alleviated. It's a wonderful book, this, and one of the ones I find that, you know, I, in reading many other things, I have neglected this. It is this complete establishment of relationship between Shambhala, hierarchy, and humanity, which brought about the planetary crisis through which the world has just passed, and from some standpoints is still passing. Is like the war, in a sense, going underground. And remember, this is written after the Second World War, the completion of the Second World War. When I say completion, it's apparent completion, because if it goes underground, and there's still the question about whether a third World War will take place, then there's, we cannot call it a completion. Shambhala, as I have told you, can now reach humanity. These are the so-called Shambhala impacts, you know, 1825, I think. well, so much shambolic activity in the early 20th century, but the impact 1975 and the year 2000, and along with these impacts from the group of initiates of the sixth degree who are making their decision but function together as a group for as much time as Sanat Kumara may need their assistance. So alignment produces crisis, and we're used to that idea when we study the integration formulas. Alignment produces crisis. Acklery process, alignment, crisis, light, revelation, integration. And then, you know, we've thrown a few others in there as well to make for greater continuity. Shambhala, as I have told you, can now reach humanity, the third major center, directly, and therefore has two points of planetary contact. Of course, the danger is that it can reach some of humanity too directly without the buffering of the energy of love. And this happened with Hitler and his so-called evil gang, people who were responsive to the first ray, but had very little love of a useful kind in their nature. So now Shambhala can reach two points of planetary contact. And before it was, I guess, pretty much limited to the hierarchy. The first via the hierarchy, as has been for long the case. And secondly, in a straight line, carrying energy directly to humanity, not always somehow transformed and rendered more adaptive via the hierarchy. Straight line, without any transmission through hierarchy. There's that word transmission. It's interesting how DK is using certain words here that appeared in the tabulation above, and consequent modifying of impact, as has been hitherto the case. So, you know, we're learning some of Master DK's teaching techniques. He may give us a tabulation, but then he uses it immediately in more paragraph form and in sentences that tell us more about the process. Yeah, well, we're, you know, pretty close to an hour now, but I will keep going if I possibly can, and maybe make it till 2 hours, I'm not sure. And if not, not. Okay. So, and I should have, you know, somehow available to me, but probably do not have. No, I don't have it. So let's just, I wanted to again show those three triangles in three phases. Shambhala, hierarchy, and humanity in the past, present, and future. But you know where you can find that. And I have discussed it frequently. But the interesting thing is the present, whatever Shambhala has done successfully to contact and sustain that contact with hierarchy. It is mainly the attempt at alignment from hierarchy to Shambhala so that the necessary adjustments can be made, which is the present mode of interrelation between these two centers. And when you look at humanity's connection to Shambhala, the downward pointing arrow comes from Shambhala direct to humanity. And unless we can say that certain human beings are within the hierarchy, humanity as a whole is not so much trying to reach Shambhala as Shambhala is trying to reach humanity. A different light is going to affect things right now. Light changes here in the temple relatively quickly. And, here's a nice, well, let's see if that works. Not necessarily. Okay, we'll just keep going for a while here. When this direct line of spiritual dynamic, there's the word spiritual, okay, the spirit anyway, electrical energy made its first impact on Earth, I guess there were a couple of very destructive impacts at the close of the Lemurian civilization and at the close of the Atlantean civilization, though Atlantean consciousness much remains with us at this time. So when this line of spiritual dynamic electrical energy made its first impact on Earth after the Great Council held in 1825, which was so important for the release of social welfare concerns, it first of all awakened men's thinking in a new and comprehensive way, producing the great ideologues. It was a period when Neptune was very strong, and later with the invention of anesthesia, maybe 20 years after this, we find the Neptunian influence. We find romanticism here, the romantic era emerging from the classical era. So ideology was very strong then and has persisted and even become very combative, we might say, when the ideology which idealizes the personality is contrasted with the ideology which reckons with the existence of the soul and its nature. So in 1825, men's thinking was awakened in a new and comprehensive manner. And it's as if two very different streams began to occur. You know, the stream which led to Bismarckian blood and iron and represented the lords of form, and the stream which led to the great synthesis and compassion of an Abraham Lincoln with malice towards none and charity for all. So in a way, you know, it was a fight in the solar plexus between the lower Martian point and the higher Neptunian point. It aroused their massed desire, that is, the people of the world, and registered obstruction on the physical plane. It found out what it was that was obstructing progress. Because unless the lines often obscured between progress and retrogression are recognized, then real progress is not possible, and men are not informed enough to choose the right over the habitual. To choose the right over the habitual is, you know, a problematic issue. It found its course impeded and discovered it was faced with barriers. The mass desire for a better life found its course obstructed and impeded. I mean, we read so many of the abuses of the 19th century, of the robber barons, of the social Darwinism, the social survival of the fittest human being, not just the animal species. And the fittest usually meant those that can overpower their fellow human beings. It's not in terms of a deep and sensitive understanding, more expressed in first-rate terms. In other words, the great lie that Hitler told that might makes right. And it should be the other way around, shouldn't it? Well, there are still people today who say, if I'm strong, God favors me. If I'm rich, God favors me. You know, the legacy of what D.K. calls the damnable doctrine of predestination with regard to salvation, and that if you're rich, it shows that God has favored you. If you're powerful, you have been favored, and you've been chosen from the beginning for salvation, and others have been chosen for a hellish fate. It's amazing the kind of ignorance that can overtake human consciousness as it thinks about an all-merciful God. You know, the prayer, you can paraphrase, oh, all-merciful God, destroy all my enemies. Well, your enemies are human beings just like you, and your enemies are praying the same thing. So it's just illogical, isn't it? And somehow through suffering and through unification and even identification, we begin to realize that we have to love our neighbor as ourselves, to love the Lord thy God with all thy heart and soul and might, and thy neighbor as thyself, as if he were thyself, which he is. The energy from Shambhala being an aspect of the ray of the destroyer, notice not the entirety of it, proceeded to burn up in the fires of destruction all such hindrances upon the plane of the three worlds. This was the deeply esoteric and unrecognized cause of the war. So obstruction was recognized even, you know, 90 years before the First World War. And there were, you know, other intermediate wars between Germany and France and other European nations. But the real world war came in 1914 and was a continuation of this will to burn destruction, obstruction, to destroy obstruction. So shambolic energy, released in 1825, continued for a long time and led to wars, some of them of a very climactic nature. And this was the deeply esoteric and unrecognized cause of the war, the beneficent bringing to an end of the impediments to the free flow of spiritual energy down into the third center. This was the reason, and it took about a century or more to get it at least partially accomplished. I mean, sometimes, you know, the first ray has to come along and clear the field. Otherwise, the beneficence intended from and by the higher powers cannot get through. You know, blockages don't work when it comes to the physical body or the psyche. They prevent the health-giving soul energy from coming through. We're told in the very first law of healing that there must be the free flow of soul energy to bring about real health. And when there are blockages, we recognize they can lead to the death of the form. And we're mostly responsible for creating our own blockages. We, humanity, through our selfishness. So, starting in the 19th century, there was a shambolic movement leading to the great wars of the 20th century. And the two great human avatars representing different aspects of the Force, as we might say in Star Wars, were Bismarck representing cosmic evil and Lincoln representing the cosmic good. So this was the factor, the recognizing of the impediments and the attempt to burn up these impediments. This was the factor which called evil from its hidden place. And, you know, that hidden place is not even necessarily the land of Mara, you know, on the astral plane, but it's found on the cosmic astral plane in a higher sort of way. And it was cosmic evil which was behind the rising of the Axis nations. Earlier, it had been functioning in relation to the French kings and no doubt in relation to the imperial period of Rome. So calling evil from its hidden place and brought the opposing forces to the surface of existence prior to their sealing. And, you know, well, the sealing is not complete. Master D.K. complimented Roberto Assagioli for recognizing that the door where evil dwells had been left partially ajar. The Second World War was not entirely successful in sealing away the forces of evil. So the forces of opposition came to the surface to, with all power that could be mustered, block the success of the progressive forces. They were evoked. Good draws evil to the surface, summons evil to the surface. Another one of the laws or rules in esoteric healing, whatever we find there can be applied to society as well as to the condition of the human personality. To the extent that this was so, mankind in the World War, he doesn't differentiate here, 1914 to 1945, was the unhappy victim of spiritual circumstance. So, you know, the appearance in bold terms of the potential for increased spirituality summoned the opposition which waged war upon humanity, summoned them to the surface. However, from the angle of man's historical past, humanity was the engineer of its own fate. DK had commented on how selfish in previous lives the members of the group around Hitler were, and he himself. So lives of selfishness led to their responsiveness to the Shambhala force, interpreted negatively. So humanity was the engineer of its own fate. But it took both the esoteric activity of Shambhala and the exoteric activity of humanity over a millennia of years, it's about 1,000 years, is it? To precipitate the conditions which made this new alignment possible and brought about the sealing, still being carried forward slowly or slowly forward, and plunged mankind into the vortex of the war. I somehow think of the opera Parsifal by Richard Wagner, and I think about the arch magician Klingsor, who had in his possession the spear of destiny, and who had been one of the knights of the Grail, or at least attempting to be so, and deviated, and from that point on sought to see every other knight of the Grail deviating, the symbol for the deviant knight being Amfortas, who was suffering constantly from his fall from grace, as if he had been affected by the spear and was forever wounded because of his fall. Well, along came Percival or Parsifal and his redemptive mission. And, you know, it's kind of a Christ-like figure conceived in the German mentality. You know, the Germans could not conceive how the true Christ could not have been a blonde Aryan, you know, especially since the major perpetrators of this myth looked so different from the blonde Aryan. That was all I can say. Anyway, the ceiling of the door, even after the Great War, was not complete and is not complete to this day. And the task is to make sure that we do not fall into an external war. A psychological war is already raging. An external war, which could mean the complete present defeat of humanity and the need to start all over again, to see whether a properly responsive human race could not be instituted. So this impelling downward energy from the highest center penetrated not only to the heart of humanity, but into the very depths of the mineral kingdom, implicating also the animal and vegetable expressions of divine life. I guess we find it easier to conceive of how, through weaponry and some very advanced weaponry, Vulcan and the mineral kingdom were implicated in the previous Great War of some 31 years. the mineral kingdom brought mass death, or the way it was used, brought mass death to humanity. And then, of course, the great plague following the war. You know, after the fourth ray weakens humanity, then it is very susceptible to epidemics. And that must be the case today in the year 2020. It was certainly the case in 1918 and 1919. But following the conclusion of the Great War in 1945, there was no such pandemic. And maybe, you know, the great Lord held his hand lest he, you know, smite humanity again. But now, apparently, some tests were not passed. And we find that a great epidemic is upon us. And who knows how destructive it could become with constant mutation and even the promise of other kinds of viruses which are more dangerous than the present. Because of this direct impact between Shambhala and humanity, bypassing the hierarchy, every Shambhala impact is that way, at least in the modern era, the modern Aryan times, the hierarchy was left free for the work of rehabilitation and salvaging, for reconstruction and for the application of the regenerative forces of resurrection. Well, there's Gemini, the head of the cosmic Christ, and a great second ray sign, and ruling the forces of reconstruction. Interesting that humanity had to deal with this more on its own and was not buffered by the intervention of hierarchy. Though hierarchy helped in every way it could, the impact was still direct. The hierarchy needed and welcomed this interlude and recognized it as an essential aspect of the plan. Well, the plan is taken in by the registrants of the plan in the higher aspects of hierarchy. And hierarchy is a redemptive body. It's not a warlike body. It seeks to somehow always bring, you know, harmony out of the conflict and unity out of discord. So we can understand that humanity had to bear this weight of Shambhala, this pressure, by itself. And that was a challenge. And still, there is the challenge. There is the impact of the year 1975. We had to wait 150 years between impacts, but not between influences from Shambhala. You know, every great decision, in a way, is an influence from Shambhala. Let's say 1854, 1903, 2001 and 2050, which has not yet occurred, still 30 years away. And we're learning how to handle the will. And some recalcitrant types are seeking to handle the will in the old personal way. And I think, you know, inevitably, they will go down to defeat, but how much suffering will they cause and for how long? On some occasions, DK tells us that the delay may be 300 years, and in other cases, he seems to hint more at millennia. The reason I thought of Klingsor, you know, the arch magician possessing the spear of destiny, was that he seemed to have existed about 1,000 years ago. And whether it's fact or fiction, Hitler is identified as Klingsor in some of the interesting books about that episode in human struggle. And that struggle goes on even today. So whether true or not, you know, the book by Trevor Ravenscroft, The Spear of Destiny, makes fascinating occult romantic reading, you know, and you can decide for yourself what sounds correct and true. So the cycle of Shambhala impact is now over. Well, at least 1825, and driving forward with pressure and momentum and focused action towards 1945, when the Christ makes his decision, final decision, to appear in person over the period of the Aquarian Age. The appeal, so over now, but not for 1975 and not for the year 2000, and who knows when it will happen again, maybe when DK brings out his third installment, we will see that yet another Shambhala impact may be found in the 21st century. The appeal of humanity to the Christ and his hierarchy has again refocused the energy of Shambhala via the hierarchy, and the direct means of the hierarchy with humanity can again take on fresh meaning, can be reestablished on a new and somewhat different line, and thus definitely bring in that new heaven and new earth for which men have so long waited. Now, it seems, you know, to me that the Shambhalic impacts of 75 and the year 2000 were direct. I'll have to consult with my friend Philip Lindsay, who seems to know more about these impacts than anyone I know, and see what he thinks about it. You know, by the way, his wonderful book, The Hidden History of Humanity, should be in the possession of those who really want lots of light on the history of our planet and much explanation of what is in the secret doctrine on these historical matters. So this is my question. Were the Shambhala impacts of 1975 and 2000 direct or mediated by hierarchy? That is one of the big questions. This will take time. Okay. This new heaven and new earth, and we know that hierarchy returning to visibility and again walking on the outer plane with human beings will bring about tremendous changes. So they will be involved, whatever the Shambhalic impacts may be, or whether somehow in the year 2000 we've seen the last one for a while, which DK said need not be as destructive as former Shambhala impacts. So this will take time. All of this bringing in of the new heaven and new earth, which is so seventh ray and so Aquarian. But the new energies and their emerging qualities are adequate to the task and will alleviate much and bring about great changes in due time. Yeah. So that's a note of optimism. And we need that. Especially, you know, we have a very severe time upon us at the moment with the pandemic and great frictions between haves and have-nots and white and black and different racial groups. So a note of optimism helps us work better. You will note, therefore, that the hierarchy has been faced with three adjustments as the result of being deliberately put out of alignment, though only temporarily, with both Shambhala and humanity. What an interesting idea. Deliberately put out of alignment. It's a bit like the fifth ray ashram being temporarily withdrawn in terms of its independent power and made subsidiary to the third ray ashram because it would be a less destructive act. I can only think that of what the fifth ray could have done from the years 1950 to 2000 if left to entirely to its own devices and not somehow reduced in its progressive capacity by being made subject to the third ray. So, put out of alignment. This was symbolized for us at the crucifixion when the Savior hung pendant between heaven and earth. So that's something we really have to think about. It's not an easily understood analogy. But at the fourth initiation, although Jesus mounted the cross, it was not the fixed cross and it was not the cardinal cross. And in that respect, really pendant between heaven and earth, with the cardinal cross representing heaven and all the higher states, and the fixed cross subsuming the common cross or mutable cross representing the earth. Now, what are the adjustments? What are the adjustments that hierarchy is faced with as a result of being deliberately put out of alignment? Number one, adjustment to those extraplanetary energies which were released into the highest center, and this was made possible by two factors. A, the direct impact between Shambhala and humanity, or between will and intelligence. This is an important point to realize. B, the temporary quiescence of the love principle as the hierarchy waited for the results and effects of this direct impact upon the earth. This was effectively carried out with much destruction in the world of forms. Now, this does seem all the result somehow of the 1825 direct impact. He's not talking so much about the directness of 1975 and 2000, but I've always thought it was direct, and we'll have to check that out and see what is said. So, under the law of assembly, certain extraplanetary energies come into Shambhala, maybe the energy of the avatar of synthesis, eventually, the energy of the spirit of peace, eventually, and the abeyance of the love principle. So seeing whether playing the role of the observer hierarchy sought to observe the effect of the will of Shambhala upon human intelligence. Of course, if intelligence is the personality, some of the love energy in the soul infusion process should have been absorbed. And then the temporary quiescence of the love principle, yes, as hierarchy waited. It's been waiting a long time. You know, it has that second-rate patience. And from the time it withdrew after the Great Atlantean War, it waited as the observer and carried out the induction of certain human beings into the rank of initiates, but all this behind the scenes. So the hierarchy waited for the results and effects of this direct impact upon Earth, and apparently it did work out. There are challenges at the moment and recrudescences of the irrational and often ignorant sixth ray energy, but in general, such was the invocation of humanity that it did reach the lords of liberation, who were able to, in their own way, forestall or prevent the destruction of humanity at the hands of the representatives in the Axis, the representatives of the Black Lodge. So some adjustments as a result of being put to the side as the Shambhalic direct impact was occurring, and maybe other impacts. Well, you know, it doesn't seem that hierarchy is so much to the side now, because it is preparing to externalize. So it'll be very present in a way. Then another adjustment, the adjustment to certain basic changes within the hierarchy itself in preparation for the externalization, which was begun this century, was begun. Sometimes you get the impression that it has been somewhat held up. And I, you know, my own theory is that the arrival of very destructive atomic energy, or at least destructively used, required on behalf of hierarchy or within hierarchy a lot of rethinking and replanning. So the second adjustment of being put to the side, adjustment to certain basic changes within the hierarchy itself as they prepare for the externalization, and they are still now avidly preparing, especially as we approach the year 2025 for the great conclave, which will include Shambhala as well. And at this great conclave, very important decisions about the externalization will be made. Decisions involving timing, allocation, method, you know, things that are internal to hierarchy and about which we cannot know very much. And then adjustment to a disciplined and reoriented humanity. Working today in the dark, it is needless to say, groping along unknown ways, appealing to the hierarchy for more light and understanding, but awakened and alert for change. And this is probably the reason that Master Decay could be given permission to continue with Alice Bailey, or even begin with Blavatsky, an awakening humanity, reoriented and more disciplined, because there's no way to adjust to the life of hierarchy and even to become a part of hierarchy unless discipline is there. And we can maybe call it by another familiar name, occult obedience. So three adjustments, three big adjustments when hierarchy was temporarily put to the side. Is it still to the side? Probably not. Will there be shambolic impacts in the future? We don't know. Immediate future. Will they be mediated impacts? We don't know if they exist. If they exist, will they be mediated? And were the DK seems to hint that the 2000 impact need not be so destructive. That sounds like some buffering occurs, some transformation of the direct force. So, you know, can it be that the 1825 was really, really the direct impact in an unbuffered manner? And what about 1975? There were wars and such, but there was also a tremendous movement towards synthesis through the telecommunications system, the computerization of the world, which relates to omnipresence and the third aspect of divinity. And it does not seem, in retrospect, as destructive. Though the 2000 Shambhala impact did foresee the possible war between religions, beginning in a most noticeable way through the attack upon the World Trade Center in the United States. And, you know, militant Islam emerging and attempting to seek its revenge upon Christianity for maybe so many abuses of the past. So extraplanetary energies came in. Changes within hierarchy occurred. And humanity was more disciplined. How do you deal with them? How do you deal with a more disciplined and ready to learn humanity? Yes, humanity is ignorant, but it need not be as ignorant because of its acquired discipline and reorientation, acquired very much through suffering. Well, there's a lot here that is, okay, let's see how much we can do or should do. These adjustments are proceeding with rapidity. That's 1946 we're talking about here. The technique being employed is realignment through a definite aspect of the will as far as Shambhala is concerned, and by an outpouring of love as far as humanity is concerned. So the adjustments continue, and I'm sure that we cannot look at these adjustments and deem them utterly completed. I think they do persist to this day. But the hierarchy becomes of greater and greater proximate moment. They're getting closer all the time. Like closer being a vibratory condition, and we're not talking necessarily about, you know, closeness on the physical plane, though that too will result in the planetary centers. So all kinds of changes and preparations are being made internally as far as hierarchy is concerned. And it'll be a different world when hierarchy walks with mankind. There is that, sort of old story about Christ and his disciple walking together along the shore, and their footprints are in the sand, and suddenly there's only one set of footprints. And the disciple says, Lord, why did you go away? Why did you abandon me? Why was I left walking alone? And the Lord responds, well, that, my son, was when I picked you up and carried you, and the footprints were mine. It's a good story, and very educational, I think. So this act of the will is carried out by three department heads in the hierarchy, under the guidance of the Christ, and by the Chohans of the seven major ashrams. Okay, well, the Manu, the Maha Chohan, excuse me, who was changed, office was changed in 1925, I believe. And the Chohans, Master Moria, Master K.H., Paul the Venetian, Master Serapis, Master Hilarion, Master Jesus, and the unnamed so far but speculated upon seventh ray Chohan. So this is an act of will. Realignment through a definite action of the will, as far as Shambhala is concerned. So Shambhala pours its will into humanity in a finely attuned and finely adjusted manner. It has to be the power that touches and then withdraws, otherwise it destroys the form. So these are the ways that the adjustments proceed. And finally, there will be an overall adjustment which puts all the three centers in the future into the proper relationship. They constitute a group of 10, very important, to whom this task has been committed. It's Kabbalistic in its design, for the reason that they are the only members of the hierarchy who possess the needed qualifications and in whom the will aspect is adequately developed. The task of pouring out the love principle in a new and dynamic manner is being carried out by the masters and by all initiates who have taken the third initiation. The stream of love will focus itself each coming new moon. So that's very important to recognize when we are doing these full moon meditations, that the will is coming through the three great lords and the Chohans and the love through the various masters. And I suppose the masters, the masters who are presiding or will preside over the subsidiary ashrams. So each full moon in a special act or demonstration of love. That had gone down a bit, but now I've got it. And I hope that's right. Okay. You will note also how fully occupied The hierarchy is with work, preparatory to emergence, and with those plans and activities which will lead to renewed interior activity based not on a lack of previous unity and integrity, but on the absorption of the new energies made available via Shambhala of these extraplanetary forces to which I have earlier referred. Well, we do know that these avatars, such as the avatar of synthesis and also the spirit of peace, are extraplanetary. And who knows how many such forces have been impacting Shambhala and have to be assembled and distributed and transmitted in the proper way. So all kinds of internal organizations and reorganizations are in process to accompany, or which are, you know, to a great extent responsible for the drastic conflicts and reorganizations and reconnections that we witness within humanity. Very painful at first, I suspect, because the old has to be relinquished. Well, you know, in the rules, there is Mercury. Mercury speed the group upon the upward way, and let Taurus bring illumination. How does it go? I just have to take a look at it here. Let Mercury speed the group. Let's see. Yes, and maybe I can make this simple. You won't see it right now, but Mercury, speed the Mercury speed. Okay. So basically, let the group, here it is, yes. This is what is happening behind the scenes. And to which we, who are still in Pisces, are adjusting. Let the group serve as Aquarius indicates. Let Mercury speed the group upon the upward way. And let Taurus bring illumination and the attainment of the vision. Let the mark of the Savior, as the group toils in Pisces, that's where we toil, be seen above the aura of the group. That's it. Rule number 12 for disciples and initiates. So I hope you know, I didn't show it, but just turn to Rays and Initiations. In the beginning of the book, it lists all the rules. Rule number 12. And so all of these important signs for the New Age, Aquarius ruling hierarchy, Taurus, the new group of world servers, and Pisces, in this case, ruling those who need help in making the transition under the love of hierarchy and the will of Shambhala into the New Age. This task of reorganization prior to moving onward will be completed by May 1946. So we're just being given an idea of the inner workings of hierarchy and how very busy, very occupied they are in ways that we could not suspect. Then the task of the new alignment with humanity will be started, and the great work undertaken, which will proceed for several hundred years. And you kind of wonder, you know, what's he talking about there? hierarchy is fully occupied. There's an interior process. Shambhala energies are being absorbed. And Shambhala is impacting humanity very definitely. Whether it's a mediated or unmediated impact. Okay. This task of reorganization prior to moving outward, which will come, I would say, starting from 2025, which is almost upon us, up till the transition into the Aquarian age without the vestiges of the energies of Pisces and of the sixth ray. Of course, those energies remain in a way, but not conditioning the planet in an equinoctial age. So a new alignment with humanity will be started and the great work undertaken, which will proceed for several hundred years. Does it mean that it will take that long for the hierarchy to complete its externalization? And then, of course, there's all the work that Christ will do in cooperation with the Buddha and using the vestures of the Buddha, and the work of the Avatar of Synthesis and the Spirit of Peace. All of this contributing to the wonder of the New Age, we cannot yet conceive what that will be. We are on page 538. And I'm, you know, it's all so deep. It certainly requires a deeper kind of analysis than we've been able to give here. Okay. And this is 20. Now, what I'll do is, there's so much in this section. I'll take it down. To here. Well, we're looking at Shambhala, hierarchy, and humanity. I'll go back and find out or reaffirm what these bolded sections look like. This is program 63, approximately 2 hours, and just approximately 2 hours, and it's 534 to 538. Sometimes I mistakenly leave the page numbers that no longer belong. And it is the 1st of June. And we'll begin with number 64. And we don't know how long it will last. And it will begin on page 538. And we don't know the day on which it will begin. Will it be today? Or will the first meditation on the energy of love in relation to Gemini make that impossible? Okay, I think that will be it. This is a two-hour program. Thank you for your attendance and for thinking along with me as I try to think of things that may help to bring a greater appreciation of unity into our consciousness. As for the oneness factor, the synthesis factor, well, maybe that's covered in another series that I call Identification as Being. It's so intense that I almost have to be intermittent about it. There have been three periods of presentation with that, and it looks like very shortly I'm about to begin a fourth. So hopefully all this works well, and we will be in touch with you as soon as may be possible. Meanwhile, on Makara, these things are being put, and they'll also be put as well upon the YouTube. Okay. See you then.